did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. Alan Parker is a lawyer who is watching the new Supreme Court closely.
I believe that the court is probably 1 to 3 years away from reversing Roe v. Wade.
He's filed a brief in a case the court is considering that could come awfully close. It's a Mississippi law that would ban abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Parker heads a group called the Justice Foundation. He wants Roe to be overturned, and he's been working at it for years.
What you really need is to win in the court of public opinion. You need to win in the legislature, and then you need to win in the actual courts.
Parker thinks abortion opponents can now win at the Supreme Court because it tipped to the right with Donald Trump's 3 appointments. And he argues that options for pregnant people have changed because of a new kind of law.
The safe haven law in all 50 states says that a woman can simply drop her baby off at a hospital or fire station within a certain period of time after birth. The essential freedom of Roe was freedom from unwanted child care.
For the lawyer who argued to legalize abortion almost 50 years ago, it was much more than that.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
Sarah Weddington spelled out for the 9 male justices what it means to be pregnant.
Pregnancy to a woman is perhaps one of the most determinative aspects of her life. It disrupts her body, it disrupts her education, it disrupts her employment, and it often disrupts her entire family life.
Weddington said a woman should be free from government interference when she decides whether or not to give birth.
This certainly, in as far as there are any rights which are fundamental, is a matter which is of such fundamental and basic concern to the woman involved that she should be allowed to make the choice as to whether to continue or to terminate her pregnancy.
The court's ruling in 1973 was huge news.
The Supreme Court today ruled that abortion is completely a private matter to be decided by mother and doctor in the first 3 months of pregnancy. The 7-2 ruling to that effect will probably result in a drastic overhaul of state laws on abortion.
That was a good prediction. It did. Most states did not allow any abortion before the Roe decision. All of a sudden, abortion before a fetus was viable became legal in all 50 states. But the justices left plenty of room for states to regulate abortion in incremental ways. And they did, including over time, collecting detailed, intimate information about each termination and the person getting it. Oklahoma's health department, for example, keeps a copy of every sonogram taken of a pregnancy at abortion clinics. Missouri, for a while, made a spreadsheet of women's periods. No other patients are treated this way, so who is benefiting from all of this personal information that's being collected? Reporter Ashley Cleek's investigation starts in a clinic waiting room.
It's Thursday afternoon at Camelback Family Planning in Phoenix, Arizona. All the chairs in the waiting room are full.
All right, so we're going to have to go through the door so we can schedule your follow-up and take payments.
A woman with pink hair holds a toddler. A 17-year-old in a racerback tank top and running shorts sits next to her mom. Another woman, who looks to be in her 20s, sits close to a man in a floppy hat.
Do you want morning or afternoon?
This is a small, private practice, one of five abortion clinics in Phoenix, a city that's home to more than 600,000 women of childbearing age.
So a tour.
Yeah.
So a tour.
Okay.
Dr. Gabrielle Goodrick owns and runs this clinic. She started out in family practice. Now, she primarily does abortions.
Basically, it's a family medicine office that I kind of made into an abortion clinic.
How many years ago?
In 2006. We moved in here.
Like, it looks like every normal doctor that I've ever been to.
Yeah, it's just a doctor's office. So
Dr. Goodrick has been doing abortions for over two decades. In that time, the procedures have changed a little. But as in many states, the rules have changed a lot. Here in Arizona, the legislature started pushing through a lot of abortion regulations about 10 years ago.
Boom. You know, it was just relentless. Pretty much every 6 months to a year, we had new regulations.
New regulations meant that Dr. Goodrick had to buy new, expensive equipment. She had to add an extra appointment for each patient for mandatory counseling, with a 24-hour wait in between. After a state law passed saying only licensed doctors can perform abortions, including handing patients pills for a medical abortion, Dr. Goodrick had no use for her nurse practitioner. About 10 years ago, the state started to ask for data on abortions.
How many take place in the state? What age group? You know, and looking at those kind of numbers may be important.
Goodrick is also required to tell the government which staff members help with each procedure and give detailed information about each patient. All of this is relatively new in Arizona.
And then when they started requiring it, then it's just snowballed. Like, not just simple demographics of age, maybe county, gestation, type of abortion, you know, marital status, just all kinds of data, why they want to do it.
Dr. Goodrick says all of these regulations have taken a toll. In 2011, there were 15 abortion clinics in Arizona. Now, there are nine.
So, I hope you're getting good information for your story.
The head nurse in this clinic is a woman named Rose. Rose asked us not to use her last name because she doesn't want to be harassed. All day, Rose pivots between patients and paperwork.
I mean, can you imagine these stories that we hear all day, every day? And they're stuck to deal with all this crap.
Right now, she's stapling documents and checking over patients' forms. Much of this information will eventually get uploaded to the State Department of Health. On the wall by her desk is a framed cross stitch that spells out her motto in black lettering.
Do no harm, but take no shit.
I walk with Rose across the hallway to a lab where she picks up a plastic container of pee.
You're doing a pregnancy test?
Yeah. All right, she's 2 seconds pregnant. Okay.
The patient, Rebecca, is in an exam room down the hall.
Well, I broke up with my boyfriend, and then about a week later, I found out I am pregnant, maybe 4 or 5 weeks along.
For privacy, Rebecca asked Jess to use her first name. Rebecca's 19. She has long platinum blonde hair that falls over her shoulders and a thin silver loop through the left side of her nose. Her eyes look tired. Those test results confirm what Rebecca already knows. She's been obsessively repeating pregnancy tests, and by this point, she's taken 9.
They all came out positive. I took one this morning, took one at another clinic. Yeah, I wanted to be sure before I made any type of decision.
When Rebecca got here, she expected to provide some information, like at any doctor's office.
Just like my general information, I had to sign like a bunch of things, like, you're going to be seen by the doctor, this is what they're going to tell you, my consent form.
But then the question started going beyond her health and consent. By law, the clinic needs to ask her race, level of education, and whether or not she's married. One form asks why she decided to have an abortion.
And oh, that made me want to just scream. Don't ask me my reason. It's none of your business.
This is part of Arizona's newest abortion law, passed in 2018.
You want me to check a box while I'm having an abortion? No, I can't just put my life in a little line in a box and click check. That's not who I am.
The form has boxes to check next to possible answers. Are you having an abortion for your emotional health? Because of incest? Rape? Relationship issues? Rebecca says none of these reasons explains her decision.
It wasn't just one decision why I'm having it. It's not my mental health or money. There are so many reasons, and they will never understand why each and every woman has an abortion, because everyone has a different story.
Since the early days of legal abortion, government agencies have collected some basic data. Mary Ziegler, a professor at Florida State University who specializes in abortion history, says researchers did not have good data on abortions back then. And they had real questions.
Whether abortion, when performed legally, was safe or not, whether the states that had changed their laws were seeing better health outcomes.
Back in those early days, the federal government tried to standardize abortion data and treat it like any other public health information around pregnancy.
Like miscarriage data or premature delivery data.
The Centers for Disease Control made a form and asked doctors to report each abortion.
To compare that from state to state and country to country.
Abortion opponents read the data too. Some wanted to amend the Constitution to ban abortion after Roe v. Wade.
But the movement recognized that that was going to take time.
So opponents concentrated their efforts on lobbying states, pushing for more incremental changes like waiting periods and spousal notification. And according to many activists, it's because of these state efforts that data collection ballooned.
So you began to see data collection and record-keeping requirements written into kind of big abortion restriction legislation, right? So those obviously had a different kind of agenda behind them than some of the earlier data collection stuff we had been talking about. Partially, I think, so abortion opponents could make the case that abortion was bad for patients and bad for the country, but also so that abortion opponents could paint a kind of unflattering picture of who had abortions and why.
Some states have been asking women why since the 1980s. Now, more than a dozen states require clinics to collect women's reasons and pass that information on. One state asks whether a woman is HIV positive. Another asks if the reason she wants an abortion is because she's not married or she's on welfare. Dr. Goodrick sees no health-related reason to ask why.
This is not something any woman in the United States has to justify to any agency, any person, or even myself. If they want to talk to me about their reasons and they want to get that off their chest or they need someone to talk to, fine. But I don't care why you're getting an abortion, okay? You're here. You have a legal right to get it under a certain gestation. The state doesn't ask people why, you know, they choose to have a child.
In the clinic, facing the question why and the list of possible answers, Rebecca found one option that felt okay.
I checked, it's none of your business. I declined to answer. It's not the state's business. It's not the doctor's business. It's not even my friend's business. It's my body, my decision, my life.
Rebecca wants to know who thinks her reasons are their business. The answer, at least in Arizona, is Kathy Harrod.
Oh, here she is.
Hello.
Hi.
This is Kathy. Is this Ashley, I assume?
Oh, great. Yes, this is Ashley.
Okay.
Hi, Kathy. How are you?
Good.
Kathy leads the Center for Arizona Policy, a conservative lobbying group that she describes as a Christian evangelical organization. Elected officials shower the group with love in promotional videos.
And Center for Arizona Policy has courageously stood up and said that we're going to be a voice for the unborn. And we're going to
Trent Franks was one of the strongest anti-abortion members of Congress for years.
There is one team here at the state capitol who we can always count on, and they are the Center for Arizona Policy team. They are here.
Former state rep Kimberly Yee is now state treasurer.
They're the ones that on a day-to-day basis will track us down in the hall, send us an email, call us on the phone, meet with us to explain the issues to us.
Kirk Adams was Speaker of the Arizona House when he said this. Later, he served as a top aide to the current governor. Kathy started pushing abortion regulations in Arizona about a decade ago. At the time, a Democratic governor who vetoed several bills restricting abortion had just left office. So even with a consistently Republican legislature, Kathy felt that Arizona had fallen behind many other states. The state didn't even require clinics to count the number of abortions. So that was the first law Kathy got passed.
Before the first abortion reporting law in Arizona, the numbers were all over the place. So you really didn't know what was happening with abortion in Arizona or how to meet the needs of women or what was really going on.
Remember that series of new abortion regulations Dr. Goodrick called relentless? Kathy Harrod and her organization pushed hard for them. The 24-hour waiting period, the ban on nurses performing abortions, the mandatory ultrasound. Kathy says her bottom line is to help women, to, quote, meet their needs, is the way she often puts it. For example, she says, patients deserve to see a doctor in person. So in 2011, she got a bill passed that bans telemedicine for anything related to abortions. For a patient, that means two visits to a clinic, one for state-mandated counseling, another for the procedure. Then, the year before Rebecca got an abortion, Kathy proposed that anyone seeking one in Arizona must tell the government why.
Obviously, if you want to try to reduce the number of abortions or better meet the needs of women, that if you know why they are having an abortion, then you obtain the data to be able to help meet the needs of women.
Kathy's group wrote a bill, got it on the legislative agenda, and then testified in support.
Okay, we have Kathy Herod. Welcome. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. As a woman...
Daniel Hernandez is a Democrat on the committee.
Mr. Hernandez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Herod.
He asked if knowing why women get abortions would lead to policies that reduce unwanted pregnancies.
So if this were to be put into effect and the data showed that one of the reasons why women were seeking abortions was lack of access to affordable and accessible birth control, would you be supportive of making sure that women have, let's say, a 12-month prescription instead of a 1-month prescription for birth control?
Okay, you can answer this, but this is actually outside the scope of this bill.
That's the committee chair interrupting, a Republican named Eddie Farnsworth. Farnsworth received thousands of dollars in campaign contributions from a group associated with Kathy's organization.
Answer quickly, and then let's limit it to the bill, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hernandez, obviously would have to look at the data. I think it's a much longer discussion on sex education and access to birth control that's separate from this discussion.
And it stays separate. The bill passes along party lines. Besides the why question, it also requires clinics to report any complication, however minor, and the medical specialty of the doctor performing the abortion. The language of this Arizona bill closely resembles a template written by a national anti-abortion group, Americans United for Life. Katie Glenn is a lawyer there.
We have always sought to provide lawmakers with information on how to pass good laws, how to pass defensible laws. That's what AUL attorneys have been doing long before I was even born.
Americans United for Life is a driving force behind all this data collection. It lobbies states to require clinics to give state health departments detailed information about each abortion.
It's really about understanding what's going on in these facilities, whether they're following the law, whether they're safe, whether they're sanitary, whether they're providing informed consent. Like, reporting information is all about understanding what's going on inside.
I asked Katie why she thinks it's important for the government to track why women have abortions.
Why ask women why? Why ask their reason?
Well, I think if we want to understand the motivations that drive women towards abortion, we need to ask the very simple question of why they showed up that day. What is missing that makes them feel like this is where they need to be and what they need to be doing?
But here's the thing. There's already a lot of data about why women have abortions. There are surveys from the Guttmacher Institute in 1998 and 2005, a study by the National Institutes of Health in 2017, and data from other states that ask this question. And all of this data points to the fact that women have abortions for multiple reasons. The most common reasons given are, I'm not ready for kids, I have enough children, or I have concerns about money, work, school, or my relationship. Supporters of abortion access say these reasons show women are evaluating their own circumstances responsibly. But so far, all this data gathering hasn't changed laws to solve the problems women cite.
Well, if it's not going to be used for policy, it's a private kind of question. So why have to divulge it to the state?
Well, I think it's used for policy less in a, we are going to pass this law, and more in a, what kind of programs are we doing? I think it's much more providing the information to the public so that if there are private charities that want to assist women. They understand where the need is greatest and what the need really is. It's not just about lawmakers. It's about us understanding as a whole society what's going on here.
Dr. Gabrielle Goodrick says she knows what's going on.
I mean, there's no beating around the bush. I mean, they want to ban abortion.
Anti-abortion groups are trying to do that in many ways. One strategy, says Professor Mary Ziegler, is to use that why question to force the public and lawmakers to judge a woman's reason to end her pregnancy.
There's been a longstanding effort since at least the 1980s by anti-abortion people to say essentially that most abortions are for reasons that a lot of Americans would disapprove of or would find frivolous, and that for that reason, most Americans should be less troubled by abortion bans than they might think at first. And also, I think, to set the precedent that abortion isn't about autonomy or you can make the decision for yourself. It's establishing a precedent that the state can decide when you do or don't have a legitimate reason.
Some states already have. New laws in a dozen states that ban almost all abortions do not include exceptions for reasons like rape or incest, which have been standard for decades. But even though these laws have passed, they can't go into effect unless Roe v. Wade is overturned.
Thank you to Ashley Cleek and Type Investigations for that story. Reveal is continuing to follow the thread on data collection, and we're looking for people to help. If you had an abortion in the last 6 years and are willing to talk to us, text MyData to 474747, and we'll get back to you with next steps. That's MyData, all one word, to 474747. You can text STOP at any time, and standard data rates apply. Some states aren't asking women why they want an abortion just to collect data. In certain situations, they're using the answers as a trigger to step in.
If they say, well, because the race of the child, the sex of the child, or if there's some sort of known chromosomal or some sort of physical defect to the child, then of course this law would not allow that abortion to move forward.
That story next on Reveal.
Support for Reveal comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/reveal. That's odoo.com/reveal. Odoo, modern management made simple.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. A network of anti-democratic groups are attacking these freedoms, seeking to force us all to live by their narrow beliefs. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/MJ.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. In the 5 decades since Roe v. Wade, anti-abortion activists have taken to the streets to make their case. Protests outside abortion clinics are common.
Murderer! You're a murderer! Shame on you!
And in recent years, anti-abortion campaigns have targeted Black communities,
Billboards along roads and highways show pictures of black children, and messages like, "The most dangerous place for an African American is in the womb." Black people make up about 13% of the U.S. population, but black women have about a third of all abortions.
The message is simple, that black children are an endangered species because of too many abortions in the black community. The billboard's idea that abortion is genocide has made a comeback in some parts of the black community.
More recently, activists have borrowed the language of the Black Lives Matter movement.
The black lives killed by black men matter, right? Yes? The black babies killed in the abortions clinics matter, right?
This idea of abortions adding up to a black genocide is very potent, given this nation's history from slavery to lynchings to mass incarceration.
So when the terminology of black genocide is used, it taps into a legitimate source of pain.
Michelle Goodwin is a black woman who's been writing about race and reproduction for decades. She's a Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California, Irvine.
One of the efforts here is to resonate amongst black people, given a history that we know where within the medical field, generally in the United States, there have been harms inflicted on black people. We know that there was untoward, horrific, terroristic types of experimentation on black people during enslavement, particularly black women. It resonates with black people.
Joey Fillinghain knows the power of a phrase like black genocide. He's a white Republican lawmaker from Mississippi who this summer pushed a bill through the state legislature that requires clinics to ask women why they want an abortion. But it goes one step further.
If the reason you're seeking an abortion is because of the child's sex, race, or because of a disability previously known but prior to birth, you can't abort because of those reasons.
Joey's bill passed. Mississippi is now one of six states that have passed abortion bans based on the expected race of the child. Some of these laws have been stopped in court. Like other states, Mississippi bundled race with other reasons, also banning abortions based on the sex of a fetus or genetic anomaly. But we're zeroing in on race today because it raises a lot of questions at a time when the nation is grappling with structural racism and inequity. We wanted to understand how state laws like this fit into the anti-abortion movement's national strategy. So we set up a video chat with Joey.
Does the room sound okay? If not, I can go outside.
And I asked him, when would someone want to have an abortion because of what the baby's skin color might be?
The example that I would find most reasonable to make in that type of race-based situation would be a mother who would come in, maybe a single mom or somebody like that, and would say, you know, my child is not 100% pure, regardless of what the race was. And, you know, my family's not going to be supportive of this. They're going to be upset with me, whatever, and would seek an abortion based on that potentiality of race.
We looked and found no data to suggest that abortions based on race are actually happening. Michelle Goodwin hasn't found any evidence of it either. When I pushed Joey on the issue, he brought up a claim that a lot of anti-abortion advocates make, that black people are more likely to have abortions because clinics open shop in communities of color.
Why is that? Is that because that's where the people are, so that's where the clinic has been located? Or is it because Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers locate intentionally in urban communities and offer that service to poor African-American women?
Now, that's really interesting because what Planned Parenthood does, a very small fraction of what Planned Parenthood does, tiny, happens to be abortion related.
Michelle serves on the board of a Planned Parenthood clinic in California.
The majority of the services that they provided related to contraceptive care, breast cancer screenings, ovarian cervical screenings, and that statistically we know that's true. And so when we hear sentiments like that, I think it's also suggesting that black women don't need those things. And to the more specific point, this villainization of Planned Parenthood as being the reason why black women obtain abortions, well, that just doesn't actually make much sense. It's the conditions of their lives. Planned Parenthood isn't getting black women pregnant. Let's just be clear.
Even without clear evidence, Joey and others in the pro-life movement insist there's a need for laws on the books that ban abortion because of the race of the fetus. On the other hand, his law says nothing about IVF treatments for people who need help to get pregnant. IVF patients can find out the sex and genetic makeup of their embryos, then choose which ones to use. For Michelle, this shows a double standard.
So we're not interfering with your reproductive choices, wealthier white women in Mississippi. We're only going to interfere, as has been a historical norm in Mississippi, with the poorest of women in that state. And the reason, Al, that I keep going back to the history is that I think it's important that we not see this as isolated.
But Joey insists that the law is about protecting the most vulnerable in his state.
Just like the civil rights movement, we wanted to make sure that minorities had the same rights as everyone else, that they weren't being targeted or discriminated against. We want to apply that same civil right inside the womb.
He draws a parallel between his law and the work of civil rights leader Fannie Lou Hamer, who in the 60s fought for voting rights for Black Americans.
Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America?
When this bill came up, you talked about Fannie Lou Hamer. Can you walk me through that? Why bring her into the conversation of this bill?
Well, because Fannie Lou Hamer is one of our civil rights activists in Mississippi history, and she actually was the victim of a forced sterilization back in 1961. And so what you had back in the 60s were instances where Black women, when they went to the doctor to receive needful operations or surgeries, without being told, many African-American women were just sterilized by the physicians, of course, who were white at the time. And of course, she spoke out about that in terms of civil rights, you know, that white women obviously would never be treated that way, but African-American women in Mississippi were treated that way.
What you're talking about with Fannie Lou is really different from abortion. Like, what happened to Fannie Lou Hamer was horrible. It was a forced sterilization that was done without her consent.
Right.
What's happening in Mississippi with Black women going to get abortions is that they are opting to do this surgery, that they have full agency to make the decision over their bodies. And so it's like two completely different things that you're wrapping into one. And I would also say that Fannie is revered because she fought for the right for Black people in Mississippi throughout the country to be able to vote. And, exactly. You know, if you think about it, voting is really about choice. I don't want to put words into Fannie Lou Hamer's mouth, but I would say that someone who works as an advocate to give people choice, I find it unlikely that she would be for a bill that was about taking choice away from a Black woman.
Well, I guess it depends on which Black woman you're talking about. Is it the mother that's seeking the abortion, or is it the Black unborn child that is being aborted?
For Michelle, twisting civil rights history into Joey's law is a part of a wider strategy to broaden the anti-abortion movement.
So it's a convenient playbook because it's never a playbook that's like, we apologize. Let's have a truth and reckoning. Look at what we did. We are so sorry in what we did to you. It's never that. But instead, it is then this rhetoric around abortion.
She says this rhetoric and the laws it inspires have been key in limiting access to abortion.
Because the anti-abortion movement is one that, while we've seen the efforts to do away as a whole, for the most part, the playbook has been to chip, 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 chip away such that Roe v. Wade doesn't need to be overturned. Instead, there will be the million blows and strikes where the right essentially becomes meaningless for the majority of Americans who don't live in New York or California or can't get onto a plane to go to Mexico or Canada.
Abortion opponents don't just want to chip away at Roe. They hope that as these laws get challenged, one of them will go all the way up to the nation's highest court. So the U.S. Supreme Court had a chance to hear a case about this from Indiana, but they let a ruling stand that tossed out the ban on abortion based on race. Do you hope the Supreme Court will have another go at this?
I would love that. What we've been arguing for all along, those in the pro-life community, is that this ought to be a state-by-state decision. We're not claiming that all abortion should be banned outright. We're just simply saying that the Roe v. Wade put a one-size-fits-all across the whole country ought not to be the case.
The argument you just made was that this is like basically states' rights. And whenever I hear states' rights, it sets off an alarm bell to me because, you know, I mean, at the root of the state right question comes slavery. The idea that like different states can put different values on different lives, and that what the federal government is supposed to do is maintain a fair balance for everybody.
I understand the argument, and you're going to continue having that, I think, until and unless the Supreme Court says, look, back in 1973, we overstepped. This is really an issue better reserved to the states, and we're going to let 50 states determine and the territories determine how they want to handle this particular issue of when life begins and do the rights of the mother outweigh the rights of the unborn or vice versa. I mean, it's a very sticky issue, and I certainly don't envy the judges or justices that will be hearing these cases.
That's State Senator Joey Fillinghain from Mississippi. We also spoke with UC Irvine Law Professor Michelle Goodwin. Our story was produced by Neroli Price. This idea of whose rights matter more, the mother's or the fetus's, isn't just about abortion. And as courts weigh in on it, there can be big consequences for pregnant people.
So we have cases of women being arrested for falling down steps during pregnancy, women being arrested for smoking marijuana during pregnancy, women who've been charged with murder because they've had a stillbirth.
That story next on Reveal.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. When people like Mississippi State Senator Joey Fillinghain talk about the rights of unborn children, they're talking in terms of abortion. And as the concept of fetal rights has grown, so have increasingly severe restrictions on abortion in many states. But constitutional rights for fetuses don't just come into play for people seeking an abortion. Reveal's Emily Harris winds the clock back 33 years to a situation that has nothing to do with abortion, but helps us understand how fetal rights laws, if they're upheld in courts, may change the lives of pregnant people who want to keep their babies.
It's a warm, pleasant day in New York City, mid-June 1987, when Lynn Paltrow's phone rings.
I got a call from a judge's chamber in Washington, D.C., saying, we have this case, we might need you to help.
Lynn is a young lawyer. She's working for the ACLU. Mostly, she fights laws that restrict a person's right to abortion, which is still pretty new. It's only been 14 years since the Supreme Court decided Roe versus Wade. This case is different. Administrators at George Washington University Hospital want a judge to order a cesarean section on a pregnant woman.
And I spent the day on the phone as a hearing, an emergency hearing was called to determine what rights the fetus inside of her had.
Because the woman doesn't want the operation.
Her name was Angela Carter. She'd been critically ill with cancer, survived, went into adulthood, got married, got pregnant. She had had an entire leg and half her pelvis removed. She wanted to be pregnant. This was not an abortion case. But when she was 26 weeks pregnant, she had a recurrence of the cancer, and she was very, very ill.
The court record suggests that Angela wants to stay alive as long as she can. But word about her condition gets around the hospital.
When a neonatologist heard that she was 26 weeks pregnant, and they were exploring what they could do to keep her alive, the neonatologist, without talking to Angela, her parents, or her doctors, ran to the hospital lawyer and said, I can save all 26-week fetuses. This fetus has a right to life. We should cut her open right now.
The hospital goes to court. A lawyer is appointed for the fetus.
And the lawyer for the fetus essentially argued, she's going to die anyway. The fetus has a right to life. Your Honor, you should order the hospital to perform cesarean surgery on her.
That lawyer prevails. The judge orders the hospital to try to deliver the baby by doing a C-section on Angela.
But when her attending physicians, who she loved and trusted, came to her and said, it's been ordered that you should have this surgery. You know, it could kill you. She mouthed, I don't want it done. I don't want it done.
The hospital starts surgery prep anyway. Angela's lawyer files a legal appeal. But the appeals panel says no. They order the surgery. The baby is born alive.
Born alive, but died within 2 hours because it was not viable. It was never going to live. It had been deprived of oxygen because of a tumor in her lungs. And Angela died 2 days later with the cesarean surgery listed as a contributing factor. That clarified for me the extent to which anti-abortion arguments are dehumanizing. It's a case that reveals that the pro-life position is pro-life for everyone except pregnant women.
In the 5 years or so before Angela Carter died, court-ordered C-sections had been documented in several states around the U.S. for a variety of reasons, including when doctors thought it was vital, but surgery went against the pregnant person's religious beliefs. With that backdrop, Angela's case triggered national attention.
It is an issue that's becoming a medical and legal nightmare. Courts forcing pregnant women to undergo surgery to protect their unborn children.
This was the 1980s. Joan London hosted Good Morning America then.
And joining us this morning, Angela's parents, Daniel and Nettie Stoner. Mr. Stoner, neither you nor Mrs. Stoner or Angela's husband or the doctors, her own doctors, none of you wanted the surgery.
No, nobody did.
And what did Angie say when she was told about
that? Angela didn't want the surgery either. She was, I imagine, under the impression they were going to treat her for cancer or radiation or chemotherapy.
When they had the hearing, was the judge told that this surgery would possibly shorten Angela's life or possibly cause her to die?
Oh, yes, he was told. He was told.
When Angela and her parents went through this ordeal, the concept of fetal rights was not a common idea. Since then, anti-abortion activists have pushed hard to move it toward the mainstream. I wondered how Angela's experience would sound to one of those activists now.
I'm having difficulty conceiving of a court forcing her to do a C-section.
Meet Catherine Davis. She runs the Restoration Project that she describes as a pro-life, pro-family, pro-education organization working to strengthen Black families. Catherine was in her 30s and just out of law school when Angela's case hit the headlines. She doesn't remember catching the story. But as I describe it to her, she decides the judges were right to order a C-section on Angela.
You can save one of the lives, then save the life, because she was going to die anyway. This is the issue, I think, that most of us should answer for ourselves today, because it is the life of another person. And whose life trumps the other life? Whose life is the greater life, if you will?
Catherine asks this question a lot in her work, attending conferences, testifying in front of lawmakers. Ending abortion is her passion, and it's personal.
I had 2 abortions myself, and I was like Scarlett O'Hara. I'll think about that tomorrow.
Her first surprise pregnancy happened in college, the second in law school. And she says she didn't think about either abortion until a lunchtime Bible study years later. The topic was abortion. Her feelings overwhelmed her.
The shame of the decisions that I had made came crashing in. The guilt, because I knew I had taken the life of another human being. And it was something that I had never processed through the front part of my brain. I mean, I knew it was in there, but it was on the shelf. So I didn't have to deal with it. And I didn't have to address it in a personal way to say, girlfriend, you are selfish.
Research shows that the vast majority of people who have abortions, 95%, feel afterward that it was the right decision for them. But Catherine didn't feel that way, and she embraced her pastor's help.
And that began my journey to speak against abortion.
On May 7th, 2019, that journey took her to a ceremony in Atlanta, Georgia, where Governor Brian Kemp was about to sign one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. Catherine had pushed for the law, promoted it, and now stood right behind the governor.
Thank you all so much for being here with us this morning.
In news videos, you can see Catherine over his left shoulder as he speaks.
The LIFE Act is very simple, but also very powerful. A declaration that all life has value, that all life matters, and that all life is worthy of protection.
Catherine also spoke at the ceremony.
This is a historic day for Georgia.
She celebrated what she saw as the restoration of fetal rights.
This governor is standing, restoring somewhat protection for a class of people who had the protection stripped from them in Roe v. Wade.
Georgia outlawed any abortion done after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. That's before many people even realize they are pregnant. The law also gives fetuses at that stage of development, quote, full legal recognition, letting parents claim tax deductions for the embryos and count them as part of Georgia's population. Half a dozen states passed similar laws the same year as Georgia. All have been challenged and are on hold right now as they make their way through federal courts. Attorney Lynn Paltrow is watching them closely.
It's sort of shocking that state after state can pass laws that in various ways seek to establish separate rights for fertilized eggs, embryos, and fetuses without ever mentioning the pregnant woman.
Lynn began to focus her work on the rights of pregnant people after Angela's case back in 1987. After Angela died, Lynn helped her parents appeal the court-ordered C-section. They won. Washington, D.C.'s highest court said the hospital had been wrong. Lynn went on to start a new organization, the National Advocates for Pregnant Women. It's focused on the rights of pregnant people in any circumstances, whether they're seeking abortions or not.
Because the anti-abortion movement for many, many years has insisted that they are trying to protect women and that the only people who would be punished under their laws are doctors. But National Advocates for Pregnant Women has been involved in numerous cases in which women have been arrested and charged with feticide and murder.
Here's a case from Alabama 2 years ago.
A pregnant woman shot in the stomach, now facing possible manslaughter charges for the death of her fetus. The shooter not charged in this case.
According to court documents, a woman who was 5 months pregnant had a confrontation with another woman in a mall parking lot. The second woman fired a gun. The bullet hit the pregnant woman in the stomach, and her baby died. Authorities accused the pregnant woman of starting the fight, and a grand jury indicted her for manslaughter of her fetus. Then the district attorney quickly dropped the case, saying it was not in the best interest of justice. It had been all over talk radio.
Mustafa, I just don't understand the logic behind the woman who gets shot, the woman who was hospitalized because she got shot, the woman who loses the baby because she got shot, she gets charged with what?
Catherine Davis, who lobbied for Georgia's fetal rights law, had heard about this shooting back when it happened. She brought it up when we were talking.
I read a case, a news story, of this woman who was pregnant who deliberately started a fight with another woman.
I might have read the same story.
Yeah.
I asked Catherine whether criminally charging a pregnant person who got shot for the death of her own fetus made sense to her.
It did make sense to me because, do you see, because she recklessly engaged in behavior that put her child's life in danger.
What, if anything, do you think a woman should be criminally charged for who's pregnant?
Well, I think that women who drink and drug and while they're pregnant, they should have some responsibility for the outcome.
Like jail time or?
It could be jail time, but there should at least be some kind of penalty. And I've not thought about it all the way through to suggest what that penalty should be.
Jennifer Johnson did not get jail time. Instead, she got house arrest and then 14 years of probation. She was addicted to cocaine and was charged and convicted of delivering drugs to her newborn daughter through the umbilical cord.
I was with my fourth child and abandoned by my ex-husband, my children's father, and very alone in the world.
After the birth, Child Protective Services took her daughter and a young son. Jennifer thought she might get help for her addiction, but she got arrested.
The biggest piece is the shame. To be considered a drug pusher to my kids, which took me years to come from under that stigma. I mean, tons and tons and tons and tons of therapy.
3 years after Jennifer's conviction, Florida's Supreme Court unanimously overturned the charges. Justices said state drug law was not written to prosecute drug-dependent mothers. This all happened 30 years ago, but Jennifer still feels it.
I'm just not in agreement with policing people's pregnancy and putting them in jail. Yeah, you know, I just think it's a public health issue more so than a police issue.
Right now in California, two women are in prison on murder charges because their babies were stillborn, and hospitals found meth in the babies' bodies. Their attorneys say the law was misapplied. Science comes into court cases like these sometimes, too, because different drugs can affect developing babies differently. For example, alcohol can be worse than heroin long term. But the big backdrop to all these such cases is whether a fetus is entitled to legal rights that would reduce the legal rights of the pregnant person. The Supreme Court weighed in on this in Roe v. Wade, letting states restrict abortion only after the fetus is considered viable, that it could live outside the womb. A lot has changed since then.
One of the things that's changed is nobody talks about viability anymore. They talk about fertilization. So what's changed is the pressure to recognize separate rights for the unborn now starts at fertilization.
Bills saying that human rights start at fertilization have been introduced several times in Congress, as well as in at least 24 states. As the handful that have become state law move through court challenges, expect more reckoning over the rights of pregnant people, too.
Thanks to Reveal's Emily Harris for reporting that story and editing today's show. She had help from senior supervising editor Taki Telenidis. Thanks to researcher Mary Retta and executive editor Sarah Bluestein of Type Investigations for their work on our story about data collection. Thanks also to Mississippi Public Radio and Reveal's Najib Amini for production assistance. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy Mustafa. Original score and sound designed by the dynamic duo Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help this week from Brett Simpson and Claire C. Note Mullen. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Our CEO is Krista Scharfenberg. Matt Thompson is our editor-in-chief. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveals provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.